I have these friends, Dan and Sheila. Actually, they're podcast hosts.
Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Sheila.
And we are here for a Sunday show, which we haven't done in ages. But we saw a movie that we thought was worth talking about, especially because it tied into a movie that's an old favorite of ours. So we thought, hey, let's, since that movie, the movie in question, just won an Oscar, way to go. We thought this was the perfect time to dig into it and talk about how interesting we found it. That movie, of course, is American Fiction, starring Jeffrey Wright.
Yes.
Ah.
Thoroughly enjoyable.
It is. And first off, we're just going to recommend everybody check it out. It came out way earlier, in 2023. So it's on like Amazon now. It's not hard to watch.
No. So it's free on Amazon if you've got Prime.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I would encourage everybody to check it out since we're going to be digging into it. And of course, we're also going to be talking about a film that is very much a corollary to it because it's dealing with some of, a lot of the same issues 30 yes. years earlier from a very different point of view. And that's, rewatching, and that movie is of course Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle, written, directed by, and starring
Robert Townsend,
who of course would go on to have a, you know, decent career for himself as an actor and director. He made the Five Heartbeats, which was a movie he made about a fictionalized version of the Four Tops. That was, I gotta say, a very good movie, and it was not given the, I think, attention it deserved at the time. That one might be interesting for a critical reassessment, especially since, you know, Clint Eastwood made Jersey Boys, which was by all accounts not very good.
Well, that could be another Sunday.
Yeah, Jersey Boys versus the Five Heartbeats. All right, that's a conversation we'll save for another time. but yes, Robert Townsend, of course, he's still around. But yeah, very talented filmmaker who made Hollywood Shuffle as a statement of frustration at his inability to have the kind of career, like to find the kind of parts he wanted to play. And he did it in partnership with his good friends and frequent collaborators, the Wayans brothers.
Yes.
Yeah. This was all filmed pre In Living Color happening. But yes. So Damon and Keenan Ivory Wayans play multiple roles in this film, as does Robert Townsend himself. So it's a very interesting movie.
What is her name? Anne-Marie, the woman.
Anne-Marie Johnson from, Anne-Marie. In the Heat of the Night, the TV show version. Yeah. Yes.
Johnson and, who else was I thinking?
Lots and lots. God, who plays his boss at Winky Dinky Dog? I'm trying to remember. famous actor. Like a famous, well, comedian. Very famous comedian. I'm blanking on his name. But yes, it's all people you will recognize throughout this movie, right? Even the writer of the terrible film he's auditioning for is a famous stand-up comedian. another friend of theirs, right? Here's the thing. I think where one of them is loud and the other one is quiet. They're both saying the same thing. But one of them has a bullhorn and the other one is carefully writing with a feathered quill. But they're both trying to get across the same message. And that is the central thesis of these movies, which is, how shall I put this? The nature of capitalism gets to decide, capitalism gets to decide which black stories are told. And it is because of, you know, the massive market. Only black stories aimed at white audiences are the ones that get told. And so in the end, white people are defining who black people get to be. And what's fascinating is...
In media culture,
obviously, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, we could talk about people's perception of culture defining, you know, I mean, since people's perception of things frequently defines how they treat those things in real life, it ends up becoming reality. Not that the black people are that way, but because that is how society decides to treat them. It's an interesting, it's so interesting to watch these back to back because they're coming from two completely different places, right?
Yes, and one is a broad comedy.
Oh yes, the broadest comedy imaginable.
I mean, this one is hilarious when you look at the black acting school.
Oh my god, black acting
learn
school.
Learn how
scene.
To be a black actor in Hollywood.
And 100% white professors. Oh, so perfect.
You know, and then, well, you know, and how he's gonna be successful. You know, the great success story.
Oh god, yes, the success story. And Grand L. Bush, you might remember from, Die Hard.
Yep.
Yeah, playing the successful black actor who has played pimps and rapists and doing, you know, having a fantastic career. Playing pimps and racists. Oh
now,
my god.
Is his boss John Witherspoon?
It is John Witherspoon. Thank yes. you. Yes. Okay. That's the name I couldn't
That's
come
it.
Up with. Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was really bothering me.
And Batty Boy.
Oh, Batty Boy, as, I mean, let's face it, you know, as Eddie Murphy.
Yes. You know?
His specific criticism of Eddie Murphy.
Well, yes, because he's going to get a part in a movie because...
They want someone who can be Eddie Murphy.
Yes. I can do Eddie Murphy.
And you got you get the line of guys all doing their Eddie Murphy impression, which I thought was nice. But the thing is, like, the baddie boy, right, the guy who has this, you know, sitcom on television, who is, I mean, the name is supposed to remind you of J.J. Walker.
It's Batty, as in B-A-T-T-Y.
Yes, because he's a vampire. Like, he lives with a white family and is, you know.
Yeah,
that was, seriously, there is literally a wings don't fail me now joke in the thing. Oh my god. Like, he is going after. I mean, it is a commentary on the type of, you know, black people on television you got in the 70s and 80s. And again, he's got two initials for his name. So you're supposed to be thinking about, you know, J.J. Walker, who played, you know, Jimmy on Good Times. Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's who you're supposed to be thinking about when you see Batty Boy.
Oh, well, and then he takes on the butler.
Oh, God, yes. Oh,
my
God. Where that wonderful scene where he's told that, you know, you're only, where the other guy who's going up for the part tries to tell him he should not, be auditioning because all black people ever get to play are slaves and butlers.
Yeah.
Which is gets you into the black acting school.
Yeah.
You meant when we meet Batty Boy in real life. I was confused, sorry.
No, it's okay. We were going to get to that because it was, the through line is you begin with Robert Townsend's character.
Yeah.
Who's auditioning for this big movie.
Well, not a big movie, but yes,
a movie.
Yeah.
The leading role in a black
A black experience. Exploitation film.
Yes, a black exploitation film.
Yeah.
I mean, and the riot, you know, with Henry Martin and Velvet.
Yeah.
What was
David?
Velvet.
Oh yes, Velvet, yeah.
Come on. She had
You know, you're allowed to go to IMDb. No one's gonna stop you.
Okay. Okay, I will go to IMDb.
Who plays his mother?
Well, that's Helen Martin. That's
okay.
The grandmother.
The grandmother
is Helen Martin.
Yes.
The mother is, you know, is Starletta Dupois.
Oh, that name I did not know. I did not have that one on the tip of my tongue.
No, Helen Martin is the grandmother because the grandmother is critical because you see Robert Townsend with his brother, his little baby brother, his little brother who's eight or nine, 10 years old.
Yep.
And he's reading the script. He's practicing and you see him doing these stupid moves. And it's just cringeworthy.
Cringe inducing to watch him, you know, trying to better be this ridiculous character who speaks in this insane patois. Oh, this poor man.
And you see his whole family life, right? There's him and there's his, And there's his brother and his grandmother and his mother and
his girlfriend and the house who works they at the live hair in. Salon and they all, live in this house. And she is, I mean, again, job's a job, but as her catchphrase, there's always work at the post office.
Yes, that's the grandmother. There's always work at the post office because she walks in on them as they're practicing. Right. And she has that look on her face. Yeah. You know, she does at one point wish him good luck, but he's bound and determined to be an actor. And if this is what they want, then he doesn't think about it.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, of course, it's when he's in the audition queue.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That not only, so there's the guy who's telling him that about being a black actor and it's really not respectful and it's blah. And then he gets called up and he goes. So
and he's still happy to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was trying to fake out Bobby Taylor as Robert Townsend is called in this.
Yeah.
And, so you see, but it gets him. So we're talking about a third of the way movie starting to think about it.
Yeah.
About all of these different roles. And it's so funny, I was thinking of, Benson, for example, how to be a butler.
Yeah.
Who solves all the problems in the family.
Robert Guillaume.
Yeah.
Our beloved Robert Guillaume.
Yes. Giancarlo Esposito actually owes a lot to Robert Guillaume.
With his career. Absolutely. I would say so.
I would think that there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for, that not Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad.
Oh yeah. And giving us back, Giancarlo Esposito. Of course, Giancarlo Esposito broke out, as, the guy who essentially, without meaning to do anything, sets off everything in Do the Right Thing. That incredibly memorable part of bugging out in, Do the Right Thing, where he's so fantastic. But, we fell in love with him on Bakersfield PD.
Yeah.
Where his whole role, which was an entirely a show commenting about how black people were portrayed on television.
Yeah.
His whole role is having to put up with a partner who only knows black people from television.
Yeah. there are different shows that managed to do this. It's interesting in, a weird segue is Reacher and the, black DA.
Yeah.
In that first season.
Detective.
Of Reacher.
He's a detective, yeah.
A detective, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, the expectations, because of course he's moved to a town where they don't have very many black people.
Almost none, in fact.
Yes. So, and he's just run away from the marriage and his wife has died.
Yes.
His wife has died.
So he can't stay in Boston anymore because his wife has died. And so he wants the perfect, completely new restart, which, Margrave, Georgia couldn't be a better choice than that, except,
It's Margrave, Georgia.
Turns out it's the home of a giant money laundering conspiracy. Yeah. Sorry, a counterfeiting conspiracy. I got that back.
Yes.
A counterfeiting conspiracy.
Yeah, but
to refocus us back on this. No, but we're talking about the presentation and the range of roles that were open to black people at the time. And he is not wrong in his pointing out that it was an incredibly limited, array of roles that he was going out for. I mean, a huge amount of the movie are these sketches he does, right?
Yeah.
These wonderful little comedy sketches he does. And in them, he is making the point that why can't I be Sam Spade? With the wonderful Sam Ace. I love Sam Ace. Oh my God, that's such a funny segment.
Yeah, it was.
With his dry, deadpan voiceover. And you're like, it is comedy and it's broad comedy, but he is making a point, He is making a strong point that they aren't making this kind of movie and there is no role for him to be a just a classy detective solving a crime. By comparison, you know, yes, we had Shaft. We absolutely had Shaft. But Shaft was working in the realm of, how shall I put this? God, I just rewatched Shaft. You know, the Shaft is the first, Hollywood movie. So like studio movie to have like a clearly openly gay character in it. The bartender in the bar, the Shaft regulars that's across the street from his bar. Just an openly gay guy. And it's like, yeah, it is stated, and it's not just coding. It's stated in the film that he's gay, and nobody has a problem with it.
Yeah.
And Shaft was the one that broke that barrier of all things. But the fact is, Shaft is working in a realm of, let's face it, he's the black detective dealing with black issues, and what Robert Townsend is saying, could I not just be Superman? Would I have to be black Superman? Could I not just be a detective? Why do I have to be the black detective with all of the stuff that that entails? He is like saying that there is something essentially limiting about the roles being offered to us, which, I mean, the weird part is, and this is why I say that it's so apt, because that's exactly what American fiction is about. Because he's not an actor, he's a writer, but he has all the publishers telling him, we only want black books from black writers.
Yeah. We probably should talk a little bit about that, but I was just looking at blaxploitation.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd have a whole bunch of films upstairs.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, I have a giant library of blaxploitation films.
Yes, and most of them are in video.
Yeah, on actual VHS tapes.
Yes, but of course it was Foxy Brown, Pam Grier. And she plays Velvet
Smooth or something like that?
Something anyway. Like that, yeah. Yes. You know, and Fred Williamson, of course.
Fred the Hammer Williamson is Jesse Crowder.
Yeah.
In his wonderful series of films. Hell Up in Harlem, Black Caesar.
Yep.
Like, Fred the Hammer Williamson is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, all sorts of, he's, you know.
Yeah.
Shaft did sort of change things.
I think so.
It began to change things, but this idea, right, it didn't stop you getting all sorts of other things. Have you seen Django Unchained?
I have seen Django Unchained.
Yeah? How is it?
I enjoyed it.
I haven't watched it yet.
It's, again, just, it's definitely worth watching, but it's, you know, just a fantasy about a lot of racists getting shot, so, you know. What am I going to dislike about that? But at the same time, I'm not going to say that, a huge amount of, Quentin Tarantino's career is a fetishization of black culture, but I'm also not going to say that. Like, it's a thrilling movie, and it's very well made, because it's Quentin Tarantino, who's great as his job, but yeah, there's an absolute fetishization going on here.
Oh, I know.
Like, it goes from, it's more than celebration to fetishization, with the way he treats, really, black people entirely.
Yes, and of course, Jackie Brown, that's with the 90s, because there was a whole shift when I try and think about it, but it did, it's interesting. We don't talk about that, but with the movies, right? Yeah. It was clear when Robert Townsend is doing this, right? That, you know, most people don't live like what's in the culture.
Of course.
And that goes for all media culture. It's just like, we're going to talk about media culture to some extent. And I used to talk about images, stained glass images and things in Roman Catholic churches, for example.
Yeah.
All of those, particularly the medieval ones that are so violent.
Mm-hmm.
And that is media. And I said, can you imagine you're a child and you're being brought into church and this is what you see?
Yeah.
People never quite.
These are the moments that have been chosen to, that they have chosen to emblaze in glass, in leaded glass, and put above the preacher's head or the priest's head. Like, so imagine, here's a cross with Jesus' corpse on it in the middle, and to either side, given equal stature, these unbelievably gruesome stained glass windows.
Well, and just think about, well, and it's all of the, paintings, you know, I mean, they talk about, but the paintings of hell.
Oh, and, God, yes.
Right, from Dante's Inferno in particular, all of these. But they all get there to, this was, in some ways, the educational structure.
Yeah.
To teach people who were, well, illiterate, people didn't read, it was the 16th century that brought around mass education. And even then it was limited, but it was still mass education.
The big shift towards literacy, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's when it starts, is with the Reformation period. And so you have that, right, which we still see. All I keep thinking about is seven.
Oh, no.
That is, but one of the ones, it's just like these black, like, that's what makes Hollywood Shuffle so good. Nobody's quite done that, if I may say. I hated Pretty Woman.
Famously, yes.
It has soured the song for me. it has. I have a hard time listening to the song Pretty Woman.
Because of its association with that film.
With the movie, because she's going to school, but she's a prostitute.
Yeah.
And then she meets Richard Gere, and he hires her for a week, and he falls in love with her, and they get married. So, prostitution, in that sense, sex work. I mean, we've redefined sex work to some extent.
Oh, yeah.
But I hated that film. I hated that film with a passion, and nobody understood why I hated it.
Yeah.
And about 2 or 3 months ago, somebody was talking, we were talking about something or other, and she says, you know, she says, I'm beginning to agree with you about Pretty Woman. Going, whoa, that was the 80s?
No, that was like 1990, I
90s.
Think.
Yeah, where I said all of these women, right? All of these who are now your age.
Yeah.
Right, and stuff, what they saw here with, because it was Julia Roberts, who I don't like anyway, but that didn't
help. Yeah, but don't you partially dislike her because of this?
No, I didn't like Pizza. You know the first
Mystic
one?
Pizza,
but yes.
Yeah.
And it may be partly because of this. I won't say not, that it's not that. I watched it, and in some ways, because it's a retelling of My Fair Lady.
Yeah, famously.
Right? And you can look at it as, well, yes, but this is telling you that sex work is fine. Just fine. And you'll end up with your fairy tale ending.
Yeah.
Now, the fairy tale ending in the original My Fair Lady, the book, and the play, is she marries Freddie.
Yeah.
And she gets her own shop, because that's the only thing
she actually
wanted.
Yeah.
Right, she wanted to speak English well enough to be able to run her own flower shop. And Freddie fell in love with her, and she married Freddie knowing he was kind of a doze and didn't know how to run anything, but it didn't matter. She knew more about anything. That's the book, right? Bertrand Russell. That's the book in the original.
Yeah, Pigman.
Right, but then they turn it into this play and movie where she ends up with
Henry Hill.
Higgins.
Henry Higgins. Henry Hill is, of course, Goodfellas.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just going, okay, and so that's what Pretty Woman is a remake of.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly, because you even have the racehorse scene, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's
it's not subtle.
It wasn't subtle.
No, I mean, everyone knows that it's a remake of that. Like, that's not, like, that is not a subtle reference that people didn't get.
Yeah, yeah. You know. And so, and yet this is, it's so problematic.
Yeah.
So problematic, that film. In a way that was never understood, and I just didn't like it.
You just rejected the whole premise.
The whole premise of it. It was, You know, if she'd not, you know,
well, and that's the end. Let's not forget that is the actual ending that was, you know, demanded they change from the script. You know, the idea that, of course she doesn't end up with the guy. That would be insane. But, yes. You know, to become a Hollywood movie, you had to change the ending and give it the quote unquote Hollywood ending, which is something we're going to talk about, in American Fiction in a bit.
Yeah, American Fiction in a minute, because to go back to this, I mean, this is, people do not understand how the things that you watch can embed themselves into your brain and sort of, you don't think necessarily about them all that much.
Yeah.
But they have a bigger impact. I always tell the story, and you can see it earlier on, about the fact that my mother took me to see The Third Man when I was like maybe 3.
Oh my God.
Or 4, you know, 3.
That's maybe imagery that'll stick with you.
Or 2.5.
Right.
Yeah. And it was why I was afraid. Like, I literally had a panic attack when we went through the Windsor Tunnel, and I never understood why. Nobody understood why. And then the next time
stuck
was
with you. All these years.
And then the next time, and that was when I was in my early teens, and then the next time was we went through the Hochelaga Tunnel, which is, connects the North Shore to the South Shore of the St. Lawrence in Quebec.
Right.
And I literally wanted to jump out of the car. The panic attack was so bad.
Yeah.
Still didn't understand it until one day we were watching The Third Man, and I'm going, I've seen this before. I didn't understand how I'd seen this before. I didn't remember ever watching it.
Right.
But when we got to the end, I'm going, oh, that explains.
Yeah, that actually explains a lot about your personality.
I brought it up to my mother, like when we were in Florida on vacation. And she says, oh yeah, that's how I found out. Oh yeah, I
you
took you to see that one night. Because your dad was working.
And it's a Graham Greene book, so of course she was going to,
of course she was going to go with Graham Greene.
She wasn't going to miss that. It's Graham Greene.
And it was it's a wonderful film.
It's a really good movie. Yeah.
So what happens, and that's what this film, Hollywood Shuffle, is taking on.
Yeah.
So hard is because, I mean, you have to understand that your film producers who are doing the auditions and the director, oh God.
I know.
And it is just, this is what they want, right? And yes.
Well, it's a self-reinforcing cycle. People make movies. So the directors, I mean, the weird part is the biggest statement about how this cycle reinforces itself is at the rap at the end, the writer gets the line that I wrote, I've only ever seen black people on television. And that's why I wrote it this way. And it's like, yep, that's how it happens, guys.
Yep.
You make this oversimplified stereotypical fiction, and then people see that, and they have no experience with actual people, so they write their own stereotypical reinforcing fiction.
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting because it's Robert Townsend saying, blaxploitation provides work for black people, but it big picture damages the culture.
Yeah. And that is
his take, and that is the message of this movie.
Yes. And it is broader.
Mm-hmm.
What you watch, it's why people don't like the most realistic version of the Alamo.
Yeah.
And they would prefer to go back and look at the old versions where
everybody's a hero
and you reinforce all of that. Whereas
those narratives,
all those narratives, whereas the one that came out in
the Ron Howard one,
90s,
yeah. No, it's the 2000s, yeah.
The 2000s, right? And as the historian is saying, but this is the most realistic historical film that you could write about this, given that it's a movie.
they stole a bunch of land and picked a fight with the Mexicans, hoping that they could essentially publicly shame the U.S. government into getting into a war with Mexico to protect the land they just stole.
Yes, like
that's the story of the Alamo, everybody.
Yeah, and Sam Houston just didn't get there on time.
No.
It was that simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, and our Davy Crockett, apparently, according to a lot of historical stuff, did, he surrendered.
Yeah. He surrendered and was
killed
executed.
Anyway,
yeah.
But he surrendered. Yeah. And then he was executed.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Bowie was
dying of dysentery an infection from a wound he'd taken and got shot to death in his bed. No.
Yep.
So nobody went out like a hero in this one.
Yeah. Nobody came out. Tommy Lee Jones was just brilliant as the Davy character.
Yeah. He's fantastic. It's a really good movie. But again, it's about, do people want what version of history do people want to tell? Right?
Yep.
And that's the question that keeps coming up over and over again. What version do people want to hear? What version do people want to tell? And
that's what's happening here. And
that's exactly what's
not
happening here.
Good. And, I think the ending, I like this ending. We will talk about
We're going to talk about the terrible ending of, I mean, I'm glad you said
American
it first.
American Fiction.
It's a terrible ending.
Yeah. The American Fiction is a great movie, but the ending of this movie.
Way better.
Is acting basically. In an ad for getting people to go and work for the post
office. For the post office? Because there's always wonderful. Work at the post office. It's a beautiful ending. Right?
Yes, as his grandmother says, you know, it's a job for life and you'll have a pension and the rest of it. And, you know, why do you want to do these horrible roles? And he wouldn't listen to his grandmother.
Yeah.
What started him was one of his fellow black actors.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to,
trying to psych him out. Yes.
Trying to psych him out. And it's
but
funny.
But it still opens up that question of why am I here? Why am I doing this?
Well, yes. And because so often and people still don't get it
mm-hmm.
that this moment has to come where the light bulb goes off in your head and all of a sudden you see the world entirely differently. Mm-hmm. It had happened in the women's movement too.
Oh yeah.
Right? And you still, people follow the system and don't see what the system is doing to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, wham. And, you know, something happens that changes everything. And I often say this when I teach, right, things like women's history. Well, come back and see me in 20 years. Oh yeah, well, it's fine. You can argue that, yes. But that just means nothing has happened to you yet that's going to make you go, oh shit.
Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is, and that is a movie about him looking at this system and saying, I can't participate in the system anymore. All right.
Yep.
I can no longer, you know, participate. I'm not a part of this.
Yeah.
He has to step away and it's, oh my God.
Yeah, it is interesting.
It's a solid ending, especially when you compare it to, and now let's get into American Fiction.
American Fiction, which was until that very, 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 very weird ending.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just going to say American Fiction, the writer didn't know how to end the story. And the weird part is, it didn't, either could not imagine or did not have the guts to show, well, okay, what would actually happen next? And so he just doesn't have an ending.
And I don't
weird.
Understand why.
I know. Why did
I don't understand.
Out?
I haven't read the book.
I know. So maybe you're right. Maybe it's clear in the book why he copped out so thoroughly.
And I
but
don't
he doesn't have
know.
An ending. The movie doesn't have an ending. Okay, so in case you haven't seen it,
it's
should.
It's like Mel Brooks, right?
Yeah. No, it's exactly. It is the French Mistake. In case that reference is lost on you, at the end of Blazing Saddles, and the thing is, Blazing Saddles really does, I mean, it could have had a natural ending, and it does, because they ride off into the sunset, down Hollywood Boulevard. But the thing is, it should just end with a gunfight, but that bored, Mel Brooks, and he couldn't find a way to just ending with a gunfight be funny, so he has them have a chase scene that just leaves the set of the movie Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
And goes through, and we call it The French Mistake, because goes into a musical number called The French Mistake that is being directed by Dom DeLuise in a wonderful cameo. It's a very funny, like, I think it's a very funny scene, and I don't think it hurts the movie as much as this does, because it doesn't, like, it doesn't detract from any of the messages, the fact that by the end of the movie Blazing Saddles, you know, Mel Brooks got bored with the fact that he was making a Western and he couldn't figure out how to make the ending funny. Right?
Well, yes, and he could have left it, I mean, because some of the lines were so funny, because it does go again with all of this blaxploitation,
right? Oh, yeah.
There he is. Who's the actor in Blazing Saddles?
Cleveland Little.
Cleveland Little, right?
Yeah.
Is the sheriff, right?
Yeah.
And he comes to town. You know, and the line being, you would do it for Randall Scott.
I know, Randall Scott, yeah.
So why won't you do it for me? He's a black sheriff.
He's a black sheriff. Yeah,
in the West, they desperately needed a sheriff.
The town needs a sheriff, and the governor wants the town to be destroyed, so he's like, let's give them a sheriff that won't work out, and so he sends a black guy who's about to be executed. And sends it to be the sheriff. It's a great movie. And
yeah.
I want to point out, written by Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
And the only reason Richard Pryor didn't play Black Bart is because they couldn't get insurance for him because he was a drug addict.
Yeah.
Like, they'll take the script he wrote with Mel Brooks, but you can't star in the movie because we don't know that you're going to live long enough to finish making the movie. And given the stuff that happened to him in the early 80s, you understand why people would say that about him. Like, I'm not saying, like, the insurance companies were right, but, there were some pretty close calls with Richard Pryor over the years.
He almost burned himself to death.
To death, exactly. So it's like...
Come on. Yeah, and
again,
this was after that.
Oh, exactly.
He was freebasing cocaine.
And he set himself on fire.
Yeah.
Freebasing cocaine, by the way, is essentially homemaking crack. Before crack was a thing. It was so you could smoke the cocaine. And, it did not go well for him. Is the point of the story.
Yes.
But the point is, it's the same kind of thing. It has a French Mistake ending, but here, I think it actually hurts the movie because you're invested in the characters in a way that, you know, I love Blazing Saddles. I'm not really invested in the characters of Blazing Saddles the way I'm invested in the characters here. Because would you be?
Mel Brooks makes his points, and he does it in a very heavy-handed way at times.
Oh, absolutely.
And you love him for it.
Oh, yeah. It's
his producers.
It's very
is
obvious.
Still, his producers is still the better
of those
performance
kind of,
of the movies and the stage plays and the rest of it.
The satire of the satire there is his strongest satire he's ever done.
Yes, and it makes and the ending is perfect.
Oh, it is. It is perfect.
But for whatever the Western was. Anyway, but to get back, we have Thelonious Monk Ellison, but you have all of these characters. And what I wanted to
know. Well, he's not, they just call him Monk because he's named Thelonious Ellison.
Yes.
So everybody calls him Monk.
His parents called him Thelonious. And of course, Thelonious Monk is one of my favorite jazz performers.
Mm-hmm.
He's paying, I've got vinyl.
Wow.
I've got vinyl Thelonious Monk.
Damn.
Yeah, and Cannonball Adderley and things like that. There was a particular...
So you get it. You get why, like, the name is significant for...
Yes.
...the character.
Yes, that's why. And it is, it starts off so beautifully because he's making a statement in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right? About... Writing.
Yes.
And he's a university professor.
Mm-hmm.
He's obviously not tenured or they couldn't have done this to him.
Probably not.
he was there, I suspect, as an
adjunct
author.
Professor. He's one of those authors.
Well,
who they
no, he in. Would have probably had some kind of a contract,
right,
to teach for a year or 10 years or what. And like he was just because he was a writer.
Yeah,
because
he was a successful literary writer.
Yes, and so he's in the English department, and we don't quite understand. But anyway, he's there. He's teaching a class, and he.
Yeah.
And he gets pissed off because what he's talking about is
Southern fiction, you know, fiction, black fiction of the South. And so surprise, surprise, what word is going to turn up a lot?
Nigger.
Yeah, it's just going to that. You can't not.
Yes.
And so, and of course his snowflake students who can't handle the real world, go whining to the dean. It's a very, reactionary movie in that one part.
Well, what happens is, what happens is he's saying, you know, I mean, he does that. He talks about it. He talks about the Negro experience, that is in
the line, but
literature.
His line is very funny though, is that, how am I supposed to hear the word? And it's like, well, I think I had a little more trouble hearing it than you did. Which is pretty nice.
But I still am offended by your use of this word.
Yeah.
No, you shouldn't be offended. I should be offended.
Yeah, but the reason I say it's a reactionary film in that way is that they go out of their way to have it be a white student that's offended. And that's
why
I call it a reactionary statement, because it's like, it's not as easy a conversation for us to dismiss, and that's because it's comedy, if it's a black student who's offended. Because, what do you call it? That's what, you know, the comedian who became a, I don't know if this is directly based on this minor scandal. You know, the comedian who gave up comedy to become a full-time civil rights pioneer. How am I blanking on his name? Okay, this is embarrassing. Neither of us. All right, I'm looking it up because this point I'm going to make is actually relevant because I think it has to do with a couple of things in the movie. Dick Gregory.
Dick Gregory.
Yes. And what I thought was an inspired, this is based on an actual thing that happened a few years back. I think it might have inspired this scene where a teacher recommends his autobiography, which is named Your N-Word. I'm not going to say it the way you are. I'm not from the 40s. Right. And gets into huge trouble for it. Black teacher recommending a book to a black student, but what's that book called? And there you go, gets into trouble over it. And I suspect that might be what's being referenced. Life story might be part of what's being referenced here.
No, I think that part of that is what is, it probably gave
the inspiration.
Author of the book the inspiration. And because what happens is that he gets then brought before the committee and he's done this many times before.
Yeah.
He refuses, like I do, I guess, to some extent. look, this is the past.
To play ball. Yes.
Yes. This is the past. This is what is today, whether you like it or not. But this is what existed in the past.
Yeah.
It's like, am I not going to listen to... You know, Noel Coward.
Yeah,
right?
Because of Noel Coward. Yeah.
You know, because some of the songs that he sings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, the whole thing is...
Let's face it, Noel Coward was super racist, okay? We're just going to admit it. I'm not going to pretend Noel Coward wasn't super racist.
Well, of course
they were. Noel Coward was super racist. Everybody was.
How
many times did they have to rename and then there were none, okay? People were super racist in the past. We're not going to pretend they weren't.
Okay. And if you want to, as I would say, you know, culture jam things and change it and all the rest of it, but you don't eliminate.
No, you don't ignore the past. I do understand your point of view.
The history, because that tells you how bad it really was.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how bad it really was, you do not know that things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't seem to know that. And I know this because I am teaching, right, history. And when I'm teaching,
she's not saying she's in exactly the same situation that Thelonious was in, but at the same time, you see a bunch of yourself in this character.
Well, I do see that. No, there are things that if you don't understand, this is what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was friggin' in the closet.
Yeah.
In the 1920s and the 30s.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, all these writers, for example, that I read, all of these, yes, there's all sorts of problems with all sorts of them, but they are also telling you, in terms of literature, something that is real about the past.
Yeah.
And what was acceptable, for God's sake, in the past. Okay. What I keep saying, and I think that Thelonious here is saying it too, you cannot just reject the past, and you have to modify, and you can't just jump on the latest bandwagon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the latest thing is, okay, now, I mean, this is a Sunday show. I'm going to bring a little bit of politics before we get back into this.
Of course.
I just heard this, I haven't followed up. I haven't, but I just got sort of this whole stuff. Well, it seems that, Emmanuel Macron.
Oh my God. Macron's wife stuff?
Yes.
How insane is this?
Well, I know some people who think that it is horrible because that means he's open to blackmail and that's the reason he wants to go into Russia. And I'm just going, oh, I know.
You know this is just a lie, right?
You know this is a lie. What isn't a lie, of course, was that she had a relationship with him when he was like 15 and 16.
I know, like
his parents.
Is it not creepy enough that he married his 20 years older than him teacher and their relation started when she was 30 and he was 15? Like that's bad enough, guys.
You don't have to
make up this story that she's trans, but the thing is, saying trans is how you activate white nationalists.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly the point. And I don't
want to. Spoiler alert! all white nationalists are also pedophiles. Just putting it out there, they all are, every single one of them. So they're not actually offended by how he met his wife. So they have to make up something else.
You know, it is a very, very strange sort of thing to come out this week. That obviously, and I'll tell you why. It's because they have talked about sending troops to Ukraine.
Oh yeah. Well,
that's why this is now a big.
Yeah. They're trying to, the right wing media there is trying to come up with a way to attack him because he is like, no, we're going to keep defending Ukraine. And honestly, I understand him taking personally, like, an actual Nazi ran against him, right? An actual Nazi round, and her entire campaign was paid for by Putin personally. Obviously, Macron is going to take this personally. And it wasn't even hidden, by the way. Like, she just got loans from Russian banks to run her campaign. Like, this isn't a conspiracy theory. Everyone knows. She wasn't even shy about where the money goes. She was Russia's chosen person to try and take over France so France would, you know, break out of NATO and further fracture Europe's, you know, resistance to Russian hegemony. So, yeah, like this, and so he doesn't like Russia, and so the Nazis have to come up with a reason he doesn't like Russia, and because the current, you know, Nazi, you know, thing du jour is talking about trans people, they make up that his wife is trans?
Yes, well, I got accused of listening to the CBC, and that was my problem. Why I didn't see that this was a problem. I'm just like, oh good God, I can't deal with this. I am not going to deal with this.
No, that is not the right response. That is the right response.
I'm not responding to all of this because it is bonkers.
It is bonkers.
I mean, and the French are, I mean, there are a lot of problems in France, as in the Netherlands.
Like, of course.
You know, last night somebody, well, yeah, there was this Buddhist temple that's in the red light district in Amsterdam, and they were found to be having, to be pedophiles, right? Mm-hmm. And this was horrible, and but the Buddhists, I said, wait a sec. You know, I said, don't call out just Buddhist priests, but they were Buddhist priests. I said, what are you talking about? Buddhists. Big deal. Have you not looked at all the other religions
have
in
you,
the world?
Have you not heard about the Catholic Church?
Yeah, have you not heard about the Catholic Church?
Have you not
worldwide?
Heard about the Southern Baptist Convention? Oh, yeah, well, they're not pedophiles in the Southern Baptist Convention because they're just all set up in places where it's legal to marry 13-year-olds. Yeah, they're still pedophiles. They just, that's the reason they don't change those laws, guys.
It's because they want to have the right to marry 13-year-olds.
10-year-olds. Jesus.
You know.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but I get I get it.
It was pretty funny. I have to admit that when I did this, a lot of my class laughed. I mean, it just.
Good.
You know, they just went, come on, this is worldwide. I said, and I told them about Thailand. Obviously, you guys don't know about Thailand.
Yeah.
I said the child prostitution.
Setting up a tourist.
Capital of the world.
Setting up a tourist,
industry
around pedophilia.
Child.
Yeah, just putting it out there. It's terrible.
Child. Now, it has to some extent, at least there's laws against it.
Oh yeah, it has been massive push. There has been a massive pushback through, and it was, you know, it was boycotts that did it.
Well, and it's why we have a law in Canada that says if you commit these sexual offenses in other countries,
mm-hmm.
you can still be charged in Canada.
Yeah.
So you don't come back to Canada unless you want to go to jail.
Yeah, which is good.
So.
All right. So.
Anyway, let's get back to America.
To refocus
us. Tell it's because it's such a good movie.
It is.
It is. It moves so because he gets fired.
He gets, well no, he doesn't get fired. He gets put on, take a few months off and we're gonna call it a voluntary sabbatical since, as they say, you're going to do a book event anyway. So, you know, let's just, cause he wasn't planning on going to Boston cause he doesn't want to spend time with his family.
Yes.
They're like, you've been invited to be at this book event, go to the book event and then, you know, we'll just work this out later. We'll give everybody time to cool off. So he's not fired, but he's
But he's also not getting paid.
He's also not getting paid. Yeah.
It's not a paid sabbatical.
So no, it is not a
not
paid sabbatical.
It's really a sabbatical.
And things get worse because while he's home, his sister, Tracy Ellis Ross, who's fantastic in a brief cameo, dies. And she was a doctor working at Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
And so now with this one less income and their brother, Sterling K. Brown, who by the way is hilarious in this movie.
Oh, he is wonderful.
He is so funny in this movie. Oh my God, I loved him so much.
Yeah.
And I love Sterling K. Brown anyway, but oh my God, he's so funny in this movie.
This whole movie until the last 5 minutes is moving along. It is wonderful. And you know, so his mother is clearly suffering from some form of dementia, potentially Alzheimer's.
Wouldn't shock me though, the way it's presented in this.
Pardon?
Wouldn't shock me if they mean it to be Alzheimer's the way it's presented in this.
Yeah. You know, but you know, it's in the stages that at times she's forgotten things like, her daughter is divorced.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And she starts to confuse her son with her dead husband. Yeah. Just the traditional stuff.
Yeah. All sorts of things, right?
All the ways they code dementia in a movie. We see all of that in this, you know, her having blank episodes and her getting confused about details.
Yeah. And going out in the middle of the night, trying to find, you know, home, so to speak, you know, all of the things that happen and you watch this and it is so well done and it just keeps building up. And when his sister dies, he is left holding the bag essentially, and he doesn't even have an income.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, at the beginning, you have to talk. He does go to, of course, this conference. He's on a panel.
And no one is there. Because everyone is at a competing panel for a book that is a parody of the kind of, you know, black ghetto tragedy porn. Black ghetto tragedy porn. That we are so familiar with called We's Live in the Ghetto. And you see this woman who, as we learn, is a middle class woman who went to a, you know, who went to a good school and then got a job working as a reader at a publishing house.
And then wrote this book later about
the quote unquote black experience.
But this is the very, very interesting, because what she is, she's being interviewed and she says, and yes, and I was a, you know, she's talking about all of that and says, and then what I understood was that our stories weren't being read. I decided that I had to write our, you know, one of our stories. Her name is Coraline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you see Jeffrey Thelonious, watching this and just choking because he wants to write about life.
He is literally trying to sell a book that is a modern retelling of the Persians.
And he's not supposed to do that, and it's not going to sell, and it gets literary awards, and he's considered
in the past, yes.
Yes.
But now, from black authors, they want quote unquote black stories.
And you have
the great moment where he goes into the the store, right? The book, and finds out that what few books of his are on the shelf in a bookstore are in the, you know, black culture section. He's like, and he is offended by this.
Yes. And of course he then takes all the books and wants to put them in the regular fiction section.
Along with We's Live in the Ghetto.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he doesn't want to be there, and he accidentally knocks it over, and his sister is
sister has to drag him out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has to drag him out.
Because he is a very angry man, as you know.
And he is. She is not judging that badly. 100%. He is a very angry man.
As she said to him. And it was really interesting. And so you have the family revelations coming out during this time. Like she says, and you know, you were dad's favorite, and you know, that dad had affairs all the time. And he just looks at her and says, no.
You can't imagine.
Oh yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. Right? He said, but dad ignored us. Like, in other words, her and the brother.
Yeah.
But of course did get married
got married as he was expected to.
Yes, and he's a plastic surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Living in
Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, and Jeffrey is trying to get him to, help after Lisa dies.
Yeah.
Help finance. How did your divorce happen? Well, my wife found me in bed with a man.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. And so his wife took everything, and he's got two kids he's got no contact with. Right. And so now he can't, and so he says he can't afford to help because it's expensive being a gay guy now, a new gay guy. Cause he is, let's face it, he's a selfish narcissistic cokehead.
Yeah. And making up for lost time.
Exactly. He's making up for lost time.
Right. So you get all of these different characters and their interactions, and he ends up, they have the house that has the mortgage on it. They've got the cottage.
House.
There's no money. Everything is mortgage to the hilt. They got to sell. Even if they sell the cottage, it isn't going to help anything because the cottage itself has been mortgaged to keep the main house going.
So yes, the main conflict here, and this is the difference at the core between American fiction and
Hollywood Shuffle.
Hollywood Shuffle, which is, Hollywood Shuffle is a story about a, you know, lower middle class person trying to follow their artistic dreams.
Yeah.
And this is about a rich guy trying to stay rich.
Yes.
This is like, art doesn't really come into it after the beginning of the movie.
Well, no, but it's sort of, well, it sort of does because what I mean, when he decides, right, that
he can write one of these books.
Yeah. Right? So he writes one of these books and his agent is in love with it and wants to sell it. And he says, nah, he said that. No, you're never going to get it. Somebody to sell it. He sends it off to a publisher. The publisher is madly in love with this book. It is the true black experience.
Ugh,
but when you see him writing it, right, you see him visualizing the character.
Visualizing this terrible book.
And it's just a horrible...
And it's Keith David. Keith David there.
I know.
For one scene.
Yep.
As the deadbeat father of the petty criminal. Oh, my God.
And so he's visualizing all of this and he's writing it down. And it's just... And he's killing himself laughing because it's just a takeoff on this.
Yeah.
Like Erica Coraline's book was.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, and... So he doesn't think anything of it. Well, you know, when his agent sends it off, and that's it. And so he doesn't really want to do it. But what has happened, there is no money. He was a rich guy.
Yeah.
And there is no money, and his mother needs now to be in a home.
Yeah. And so that is what motivates him to sell the rights to the book, is that he desperately needs the
money. Okay, if you can sell them. You know, so he, well, initially his agent has sold it and he goes, no. And then his agent says, well, they're offering us, I don't know, $750,000 or $1 million.
Yeah. $750,000 to just
initially,
take it off
so
the market
then,
right away.
So Thelonious says, well, no. So he ups it to something like $2 million.
Or some insane amount of money.
Some insane amount. He thinks they're never going to buy it. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Okay, that's what he wants. That's what he wants. And he's given he's created a pen name. And why nobody mentions it is beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is...
It never comes up that the pen name is a joke.
Stagger Lee.
Yeah.
How nobody...
I know, it's weird.
Nobody in this entire movie mentions Stagger Lee.
Yeah.
Do you not know the song Stagger Lee?
Yeah. It's
obviously
weird.
Nobody does.
Yeah. It's weird that none of the characters understand what it's a reference to.
What it's a reference to.
Stag. Yes. I know. See, because to be clear, the name is Stag R. Lee. And so it's clear what it's a reference to, but I guess it's just for the audience at home. But yeah, it's weird when, it's like when I was watching the show, it weirdly reminded me when I was watching the show, Fringe, right? And the villain's name is David Robert Jones. And not one character is like, wait, David Bowie? His real name?
Yeah.
Like, because the joke in there is that the villain is the David Bowie of that world. But of course, you know, I don't understand why no character is just saying, wait, is that David Bowie's real name? Like, David Bowie's real name. Yeah, and it's the same kind of thing. Like, why is no one acknowledging this reference, this rather obvious reference?
Fats Domino sang it.
Yeah.
Wilson
Pickett sang it. It's a very famous song.
I'm going, why is nobody, because it was Lloyd Price's initially, I think.
I have no idea the, you know, the origins of this.
Oh, no, And Lloyd Price and John Fogerty sing it at their induction.
Oh, wow, they did?
Into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right? That's fantastic.
For God's sake, Jerry Lee Lewis sang it. I pulled it up on my YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, it's famous
song. Enough that I know it. So how do none of these characters know it?
You know?
It is weird. It is weird. So, then we have the absolutely.
Mississippi John Hurt, I guess, might have started it.
Okay.
Might have written it.
But the absolute funniest scene, like, for this whole thing, is that, oh my God, when he goes to meet the movie producer.
Oh.
Who wants to make sure he's quote unquote for real before
he agrees.
Going
to give him $4 million
to make for the rights to this movie. And it specifically calls out, and this is the thing that bothered me, because if you ask, well, what is the main thrust of this? I think it's the book Precious. The movie Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. Because that was, it's again, a book about, you know, people on the edges, people in the ghetto, written by a novelist using a pseudonym. Like, it's definitely, and the thing that, I never saw the movie Precious. I can't claim that I did. But that is what Wees Live in the Ghetto, what the segments we hear of it are clearly based on. Yeah. And we see clips from a bunch of these movies at one point, and it was nice seeing them call out the thing that pissed me off most about the movie Precious, which, I don't know if you saw the Oscars that year. The Oscar was nominated, right?
Yeah.
But Gaboré Sidibé, who played Precious, was nominated for an Oscar. And I'm like, so this is a whole movie where, of her having this heart-wrenching performance of being an abuse victim, right?
Yeah.
That's what the whole, it's tragedy porn. It's about an abuse victim and her, you know, endless suffering. And do you know what clip they used for her performance at the Oscars when they're showing the various clips?
No.
A scene where she steals a bucket of fried chicken and runs away. That's the clip of the performance they decided to use, and eat some fried chicken while fleeing. That's what they actually used. And that's the scene that ends up on screen. So apparently the people who made this movie were as pissed about that being the iconic moment of the character as I was. So yeah, that actually made me feel pretty good. That they were just as pissed about it. I'm like, okay, I wasn't wrong to be incredibly pissed about that when I saw it at the Oscars. Cause I'm like, I'm sure it's a magnificent performance. I'm never gonna watch this movie because of that scene at the Oscars.
Yeah, and those are decisions we make.
Yeah,
right?
But it's like, but the weird part is, that clip being shown is what this movie is indicting. Of like, what part of the black experience they're choosing to highlight. And that is the speech he makes. And it's like, the black experience is this incredibly varied thing that crosses the entire, that goes back 500 years into the history of America and now stretches into every part of American life. But what America wants to buy is stuff that will make white liberals feel guilty.
Yes. And then assuage their guilt.
Exactly. And then assuage their guilt. Cause, well, they're spending money to help these poor, impoverished people on this thing. So I can't be the bad guy. Yeah. Well, you know what? Right? Let's not forget who Martin Luther King Jr. said were the real villains were the white liberals.
Yep.
You know, because they allowed all of these systems to continue.
Yep.
They were the ones with the power to do something about it, and they would rather just everything be quiet and nobody make a fuss.
Yeah.
So he writes the book, and the book becomes, and he tries to get the book stopped because he's made it, you know, he's got his money, but he doesn't know if he can be a part of this, and he thinks it's going too far. So he has them change the name of the book.
He said, how can I get them to stop?
How can I kill this?
Because he can't.
Yeah,
because he can't stop the contract, right?
He can't stop the contract, and he doesn't want to ruin his literary career. He could stop it at any time by just telling the truth.
Yes.
Because they're not going to want to publish the book if it's not authentic. Because he's told them Stag R. Lee has to be anonymous and use a pseudonym because he's wanted by the FBI.
Yes, he's on the run from
the
police.
He's on the run from the police.
Jail, right?
And
that, to get back to what you were talking about, when he goes to talk to the film producer and they're in this restaurant and the film producer's, well, I hope you're comfortable in this restaurant and the rest of it. And his mother has been left with his agent.
Yeah, with his agent.
Okay. And then all of a sudden an ambulance.
Here's an ambulance.
And he looks at the guy and he just gets up and runs out because he thinks something's happened to his mother.
But yeah, it was an unrelated medical, but yeah. That is what convinces the producer that he's the real deal, cause he fled at the first sound of a siren. Which is a very funny, it's a very funny scene.
It is, look, this movie is wonderful.
It is really funny.
The ending, as I've always said.
We'll get to the ending in a second. Yeah, we'll get to the ending.
What happens,
but yes.
Right, is this, and he meets a woman. But I think the funniest thing, that to me, the funniest thing living in this kind of a world, right, is, of course, they've got this literary award.
Yes.
So Jeffrey writes it. So
offered
Thelonious,
to be on the board of.
Oh, wait, now, Thelonious thinks he's going to be given the award. That's not what happens. They ask him to be one of the readers along with...
One of the readers and judges, along with the woman who wrote We's Live in the Ghetto.
Yeah, and two other
authors. Yeah.
Well, I mean, those scenes, I can't even begin.
Maybe the funniest parts of the movie, watching the literary writers.
The four literary writers talking about books, it's almost like listening to Canada Reads.
Yeah.
It's worse, in some ways, worse than Canada Reads, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was on it, and he lost his book. Lost, you know. He keeps saying things. This is this year's literary Canada Reads Award was 2 weeks ago, right?
Okay.
But what happens is I'm watching this movie, and I am just killing myself laughing. I can't help myself because it is so true to the. What we would call, navel-gazing is what a nice term is, right?
Yeah.
And the Buddha says, thou shalt not do this sort of thing.
I know.
This was one of his things while he was still alive.
Do not become self-obsessed.
Not become learning about yourself and achieving enlightenment does not become mean that you start doing all of these intellectual discussions. He wanted to get rid of all of that, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm listening to this and I'm just going, and they're talking and they finally get to meet, like the four of them are doing all of this online.
Yep.
And of course he's and what happens of course is Staggerly Lee's book
winds up on the list.
And Jeffrey Wright doesn't want it there. Thelonious doesn't want it there, but he can't do anything about it because it was published within the deadline.
Yeah. They rushed it out. We are told that it was specifically rushed out so it could meet the time, like, so it could be eligible for this award.
Yes. And so there you go. And then we get this beautiful scene with Coraline.
Yeah.
And Thelonious, they both agree that this book isn't worth doing. You know, now, Coraline says that it's because, right, it doesn't have any soul.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, but they start talking and he asks her why she does this. Well, I wrote it because that's what the audience wants. I know my audience. Well, I did research. Like, she doesn't know, of course, that Thelonious wrote
is the writer of
Staggerly Lee, right? And she's being straight up honest. And well, no, I just give them what they want. And he's going, but that isn't our experience. That's not you.
Yeah.
Well, no, I did research.
I talked to people.
You know, and that,
I did interviews.
I can't see that in here.
Yeah.
Right? Well, yeah, okay. It's a little iffy here, right?
Well, no, and it's interesting how in this one scene, it's almost as if they're letting Wheeze Live in the Ghetto off the hook in this scene. Because she actually did research and she actually talked to people. But yeah, you talk to... He doesn't push back where it's like, yeah, but you're talking to an incredibly limited group of people to have a very... Because it's not like we aren't saying... There are no poor people who live in abominable circumstances in the ghetto. You know? Of course there are. But why are these the only stories we're telling is the question he should be asking her. And he never really does.
And he never really does. And it's the question that Robert Townsend, though, is asking
the
shuffle. Mm-hmm. So there are flaws with American fiction for sure.
Yeah.
There were pushes, but you've got so much family drama going on. He has
exactly.
The girlfriend.
Hmm. Yeah, we haven't mentioned the girlfriend who they get into a fight because she reads his book and doesn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, she doesn't have a problem with Staggering.
And he's unwilling to explain why he's so offended by the book and her reading it.
Yes.
And his brother says, you pushed her away and refused to tell her what was going on. Like, his brother immediately diagnoses what he did
yes.
to make sure that this relationship wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. He created a problem and then didn't explain why he suddenly transformed into a dick.
Yeah.
Like, that is what happens.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah. So she's just kind of, and she rightly just says, get out.
Yeah.
In the middle of his meal, right?
Yeah.
Get out. Just.
Exactly.
Get out.
She has there is no reason she should have to put up with this.
She's not going to get into another bad relationship mm-hmm. ever again. And that's that. And so it in, and then, right? So, but we don't talk about how he tries to get out before. We didn't talk about. So he decides, he says, no.
Yes, he changes the name of the book from My Pathology, spelled with an F.
Yes.
Because he can't stop being pretentious, even when he's pretending to feed yeah. these writers.
No, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to give them a title. I'm going to tell them that the title has to change or it can't be published.
Yeah.
And so he changes it to the F word.
Yes. Oh, my God.
And if it's not clear, fuck.
Yeah,
not
yeah. And he, ouch. But yes, and of course, you know, then we get the montage of people struggling to talk about this hot new book on television and the title of the book being blurred out when they hold it up.
And then
it's a very funny sequence.
Oh, it's hilarious. And, yeah. and of course they do an interview with him and he's blacked out.
I know.
You know, so the whole mythology about this guy is.
Yeah.
Is
being built up.
And ultimately the book wins.
Yeah.
Right.
Wins the award, even though he and Coraline don't want it to win. They are overruled by the three white participants.
Yes. Who just think this is just so authentic.
The bee's knees. Like it is a story that we need to hear.
When you're looking at the marketing guy and the literary agent, like the literary
yeah. writer. Like, oh, by the way, and I just love the passing. Oh, by the way, like the FBI has been trying to get who he is out of the publisher, but they're not going to say anything. Don't worry. He's like, why would I have to worry? I haven't done anything. Oh, it's very funny.
It is very funny. But the thing is that, and that is a little bit weird, like the FBI thing,
yeah.
simply because, okay, mm-hmm. I guess they know that Stagger Arley is a
Stag Arley.
So they don't know who he is.
Yeah, who he really is.
Yeah, nobody knows who he really is, so the FBI are trying to track him down as some prisoner who's escaped.
Yeah.
Who is black.
Exactly.
Who has all, you know.
Who has committed some federal crime and was in jail for murder.
Yes.
You know, so, and he either escaped from prison or has gotten out of prison after 20 years and done some other crime that he's wanted
yeah.
for. Like, he's very unclear about it because that adds to the mystery. So we get to the grand finale, which is, and this is where the movie, in the same way that it like doesn't know what it wants to say about Coraline.
Yeah.
Right? In the same way that the film genuinely doesn't know what it wants to say about Coraline and doesn't know how to deal with her character, we get to the ending, which is the grand dinner, and obviously his book wins. He knew that going in, and of course they're not expecting Stag Arley to co-op, and then as they're talking about the book, he decides to walk up to the stage and make an announcement. And then we cut because the writer doesn't know how to end the story.
because you see his girlfriend coming in.
Yeah.
as well, because he's invited her. Yeah. So far, everything is, so far, he sees her coming in, she walks in because he's invited her to the dinner, mm-hmm. and he's apologized, and he wants to fix things, and he says so, and then he goes, and then he finally decides to get up, walk to the stage, he grabs the
award, yeah, and this award, is what I'm saying.
And then, you know, the company yeah. guy doesn't want to give it to him, but he says, and he goes to give a speech, and it is the producer who cuts him.
Yeah.
And says, no, this isn't going to work as the end. This isn't going to work. He wants to give a speech. He doesn't get a chance to give his speech because the producer stops him at that point.
Yes.
It's and not. Know how to end it.
No, I'm not saying the character doesn't know how to end it. I'm saying the person who wrote the movie doesn't know how to end it. Because the person who wrote the movie can't say, well, what would the actual, doesn't want to go into what the actual consequences for Thelonious would be. So instead we do the French Mistake ending where yeah. it's 6 months later after all of the consequences. And yeah. now he has convinced the producer to make a movie about, well, to make the movie we're watching.
Yes.
And instead of giving us the actual aftermath for this character.
Yes.
Instead of getting this character to actually have to deal with the ramifications of his decisions, we just do an ending where, well, it's 6 months later and now he has sold the rights to his life story and he has made all the money anyway.
Like, yes. Yeah, that's right. And then so we get the ending, which is
it is very funny that one of the ending that the producer wants is the FBI comes in and shoots him.
Yeah.
Because the FBI has been watching the literary award in case Stag R. Lee showed up. And then they think the award is a gun, or say they think the award is a gun and they shoot him to death.
Yeah.
But yes, and he's like, the actual woman won't talk to me. Right? But the problem is, by cutting the speech, by cutting what Thelonious actually did, the movie is missing its chance to give its thesis statement.
Yes, that's exactly it. Because you can't figure it out. Doesn't mean it isn't a great movie because, for example, the housekeeper who marries the sheriff.
Oh, no, the local cop or security guard or whatever. Yeah. Oh,
no, he's a
God.
Cop.
Yeah. He is a cop, yes.
He's the local cop.
Yeah. In the little beach community.
Yes. And that wedding was wonderful.
Oh, it's such a nice scene.
All of it up until sort of this weird 6 months later, they're making a film of mm-hmm. all of this and then the producer doesn't like the ending. Just so is that a commentary on the producer of Actually American Fiction who didn't know how to end the thing? I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
You know, that might be trying to make some kind of a commentary on
how Hollywood itself. Yeah, exactly. Maybe it is. Yeah. But like, this is your chance to say, what you actually feel about, this genre of fiction, right? This genre of tragedy porn that theoretically this movie is both about, right? I mean, I'm going to say something very unkind. Like,
okay.
I mean, you can make the argument that the movie's like, you know, rich black people have problems too.
Yeah. I mean, this is what he wanted to, this is essentially what he was saying at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's not like his life is, just because he had money and just because he was upper middle class didn't mean his life didn't suck.
Yeah, exactly. But it's right? like, there's only one kind of tragedy they're allowed to say about black people. It's like, well, come on and just say that. You know? That's my issue with the movie. So then just say that then.
Yeah, now this is interesting because the book is, I didn't realize it's 23 years old.
Oh, really?
The book came out in 2001.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. Erasure, right?
So yeah, I remember the book called Erasure. I haven't read the book. Wow. Huh. Okay.
As you said, the only thing ostensibly African American about the book, right?
Yeah.
He fumes to himself, was my jacket photograph. That was funny. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, and because it's, of course, that's all before Push and Freshes. But of course, the movie is going to be very different from the book, obviously. But, it is interesting that it's that old of a book. Hmm. Yeah, that is really interesting. All right, so, yeah, I mean, but that's my big problem. But like, moment to moment, it's extremely funny. Right? It's extremely, Jeffrey Wright is great. It is touching. Oh my God, when they arrive for the wedding and Sterling K. Brown's character has brought two guys he met at the club back to the beach house.
Yes.
Who are both 100% down to help with the wedding.
Yeah. and they take care of him. One of the guys takes, cause his mother, of course, I mean, there was a horrible scene with the mother.
Oh, I know.
And you know, it was a horrible, horrible scene in some ways. And, but so when Monk Thelonious brings his mother to the beach house and they find them there, well, one of the guys just takes over and takes care of her and gets her some tea and all the rest of it. And all of a sudden, I guess she has to change her mind, sort of. But I mean, you know, in the state that she's in, but the wedding was very touching. The scenes with his brother and the girl and Thelonious's new girlfriend are very touching. Everything about this movie, and I don't know how the book ends. We didn't read the book. Neither one of us. And I may actually pull it out now of the library.
Cause you're curious, yeah.
I'm just curious as to whether this is, I mean, it seems to be a fairly, close adaptation.
Just based on what you've read.
Yeah, sort of based, well, when you start looking at criticisms, if it wasn't a reasonably faithful
adaptation would have come up, yes.
It would have come up. That's the issue, right? So, and it takes on the publishing industry. It takes on a whole bunch of things but it lacks that finality of the issue that in many ways Hollywood Shuffle had, which
100% Hollywood Shuffle, he makes the speech.
Yes.
He literally makes the speech.
Yes.
And then, in case you didn't get it, there's a rap where they explain what the message of the movie was. Yeah,
you know? So there you are.
Yeah. Like, it's 100% clear.
You know? Whereas here...
I honestly think that this movie has no idea what it feels about Coraline and Wee's Live in the Ghetto.
Yeah.
It has no idea at the end of the day what it wants to say about that, and I think it's a problem. Whereas Hollywood Shuffle knows exactly what it wants to say about blaxploitation.
Yep.
You know?
I mean, after all, you know, Batty is Dracula.
Yeah.
Blackula, excuse me, Blackula.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, I mean, all of it was just so.
Yeah.
Hollywood Shuffle, in that sense, makes its point much more clearly.
That is, I guess, I was struggling not completely. I knew most of what I wanted to say about this movie, right? But then when I watched Hollywood Shuffle yesterday, I'm like, okay, now you have Robert Townsend, you have clarified my feelings about American fiction.
Yeah, and it is sad that it couldn't get itself together. Now, I would say, at this point, no. So is this another example of patriarchal equilibrium? Where, you know, at the height, Hollywood Shuffle is so, it puts the nail in the coffin every time.
Yeah.
It punches and it punches and it punches and it punches.
And it hits every time.
Every time it hits. This one, now is not quite so clear mm-hmm. about what it hits, because we never go back to the issue. Like, you had the perfect, and that was the problem, and this is why I want to look at the book, is when you have Coraline and Thelonious alone talking, yeah. the two black judges,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about this problem ostensibly, and she just says, ah, I'm giving them what they want.
Yeah.
And okay, is that good enough? And clearly up to this point, from Thelonious's perspective, it's not good enough and it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not good enough to just give them what they want.
Yeah.
You have to make some, you have to say something more profound than that.
Yeah.
And what we're missing here is, Cornel West. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, I needed my fix of Cornel West and I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, oh, okay. And that is where, when I always talk about endings in movies, that, you can have a so-so movie, and if it has a kick-ass ending, you walk away and wham, you forget yep. the fact that it was relatively mediocre up to that
but
point.
But a bad ending can, like, all that matters is how, I mean, that's the old saying, right? Which is, all that matters is how you feel walking out of the theater.
Yeah. And
in a very real way.
And when I basically walked out of the theater, which is my living room, or yeah. my office living room, and went yeah. to make myself supper,
mm-hmm.
I was not as pleased with it.
Yeah.
Even though I did recommend it, and I would recommend everybody see it.
Totally.
You know, but it lost something. That it had something powerful that it was beginning to say about pop culture,
mm-hmm.
about sort of the book culture. Like, even when he was, as you call it, reactionary, there is something to be said about that. And I've already sort of said it, and I wanted more to be said about this, that he needed to get up there and make a speech decrying and stating why he wrote this book.
Why he wrote the book and why it's, like, exactly. He had to make his thesis statement.
Yes, he had to say. He had to connect the end with the opening sequence.
Yep. That's what I wanted.
And then he could have gotten shot by the FBI, but he had to make the statement before
well,
he
no,
gets
yeah.
shot
make,
by
let's
the
FBI. See the speech. Let's see the speech. Let's see a bit of the follow-up of the speech, and then come in with Adam Brody saying, yeah, I can't end a movie that way. And the joke is, he gets shot by the FBI, because that's how a movie has to end.
Yeah.
We can't have and make a joke. End the movie by saying what he meant and saying what the thesis is, right? And then have Adam Brody make a joke about how you can't end a movie with a speech, and then Thelonious says, how about this? And then boom.
Yeah, you know, so that you make this kind of connection, and that would have been a more powerful. We have rewritten this ending so that it yeah. is powerful, because he has to make that speech, because he makes it at the beginning.
Yeah.
And are you saying that everything he said is wrong at the beginning?
I need you at the end of this movie for Thelonious to show me that he learned something.
That he learned something. And if it is only that there is something really wrong with black writers, because this is what the thesis basically when he began,
yeah.
and then he went and wrote this book, and he said, I made a lot of money, and now people are listening to me, and all the rest of it, and what
well,
I wrote
Well, use your
joke.
Platform. Yeah, use your platform to say that.
To say that, okay, you know, woke culture is screwed up.
Yeah.
And white guilt is real.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because we won't really help it by using the political system to fix
it. All we'll do is just pat you on the head and say, we're sorry for how hard you have it. Well,
yeah,
that's not enough.
No, that's not enough. And I think that has to be said. And that is, and as I said, and then you can have the FBI come in and kill him
mm-hmm.
because they think he's Stagger Lee.
Yeah, Stagger Arley.
Excuse me, Stagger
Lee. Stagger Lee, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, but again, Like, you can do the French mistake ending if you already made your point. The reason it's fine in, what do you call it? The reason it's fine in
Blazing Saddles
is you're not using the French mistake to cover up for the fact that you're not willing to have your ending.
Yeah, because the statement is made. Mm-hmm. And the big statement in Blazing Saddles is you do it for Randolph Scott.
Yeah, you do it for Randolph Scott. Yes, but there's no reason. The whole message of the movie is there's no reason he can't be the sheriff.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and it's about everybody coming to accept that, which they do at the end.
Yes, and they get rid of Black Bart, and they get rid of the bad guys, and they save the town, and they get rid of the corrupt governor, and they get rid of... It's a beautiful ending to Blazing Saddles, to make the point.
But it's like the French mistake is funny, and it's a joke, but it doesn't undercut.
No.
Because let's face it, the movie didn't have that profound a message.
No. I mean, because...
But it has a message.
And it's taking on all of those westerns, right?
Yeah, it is.
Of the 50s and the 60s.
100%.
And that's what it's taking on. Before, this is before Clint Eastwood does his serious Unforgiven to take on the same thing. He does a very serious form of the same problem.
And this is a very silly version of that.
Yes. Very, very silly, and it was done a long time before because that's what Mel Brooks is good at.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So this is, it doesn't get the 5 stars I would like to give it.
Yeah, but it is really good, and it's definitely worth watching.
Yes, it gets a 4. Like if we're going to give Hollywood Shuffle a 5, it gets a 4.
Oh, 100%.
Hollywood Shuffle is a weird film.
It is a weird film because it's, again, he had to film it over like 2 years with like the ends of rolls of film that people were going to throw away.
It's amazing that he
managed to make it, and he employed all of his friends and everyone he knew from the acting community, right? It's like this, it is the ultimate, actual real life bootstrap story. You know, I hate using the term bootstrap because, you know, it's, how people are manipulated into thinking that, success in your own is possible. That you can pull yourself up out of poverty, but I'm not going to get political about this because it's just a magnificent movie. It really is. Like, he's so good, and he's so good in it. Like, that's the thing. It's a really good acting performance from Robert Townsend in that. And it's very clear about what it's trying to say in a way that this movie just isn't. But you know what? It got the Oscar. So, you know, maybe we're wrong.
Well, it got it for the adapted screenplay, and
it's true.
And it may be like because neither one of us have read Erasure.
Yeah, that's true.
So now, I don't think there's anything more to say about it. Once I've read the book, I'll let you know whether I think it deserved its Oscar. It did deserve an Oscar. Jeffrey Wright should have.
I would have liked to see him win.
I don't
He's
know who
He's so won. Good in this. Yeah, I'm trying to remember who won. Best actor.
Ugh.
Hey, no. The only thing that mattered, it was probably Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer.
Oh yeah, probably. Oppenheimer. Boredom.
I know.
Hey,
there's only one man who deserved a Best Supporting Actor this year. Sorry, Robert Downey Jr. But it was, you know, Ken deserved it for Ken.
Yeah.
Have you seen Barbie yet? When you do, you're going to watch Barbie and you're going to say, oh my God. He's incredible. Ryan Gosling is a transformation. Yeah. All right. So, we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for joining us on this lovely Sunday. I'm sorry if it wasn't as political as you like, but you know, I think it was pretty political.
Yeah, the two films are, so.
Definitely, it's gonna come up. We are going to be back, Tuesday with Who the Hell Knows, sorry, Thursday with Who the Hell Knows Which Episode of Millennium. I mean, we've pre-posted them through, June, so. I mean,
not sure where we are anymore.
Somewhere in season 2, I guess. Enjoy that, but if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if there's any profiling-related fiction you'd like us to check out later in the year, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you have, if you're listening to this on an app or podcatcher, please be sure to rate and review. That's how people find out about the show. We're going to see you back here soon, but until then, I'll say that's right. Au revoir.
And have a good week.